Welcome to the Highly Objective Podcast, where we talk to cannabis industry executives and investors and go into the weeds on recent news.
My background, quickly, I was a real estate attorney. I went to go work for a real estate business for a number of years. And then me and that family started a company called Rainbow Realty Group, which is the business that I run full-time today. And we're a real estate financier for cannabis companies. You know, we have two products. We do sale leaseback financing. We'll buy existing real estate from a cannabis operator and lease it back to them for as long as they want. Basically just as a means to kind of inject capital into the business. And then similarly, we'll do senior secured mortgages on real estate. So, you know, I would say 70% of our portfolio is probably loans and 30% of our portfolio is owned real estate. But we're really focused on real estate. And when I say that, I mean like, you know, non-cannabis, traditional retail or industrial real estate value. So like oftentimes, right, Day, as you know, a cannabis property, specifically like a cultivation or a processing facility, like it will, you know, you'll be in an industrial building that's worth something as an industrial building to a shipping company, a distributor, whomever. But then a cannabis company might come in and put a lot of extra equipment, lighting, security, HVAC, et cetera, into that property. And so like, we're pretty disciplined about only underwriting the initial, you know, again, like sort of the traditional non-cannabis value of the real estate, which can be substantially lower than the cannabis investment in the property. So that's kind of like our MO and what differentiate us. You know, our lead investor is my family's business. It's a company called Gould Investors. Through that company, we control two publicly traded REITs, both on the New York Stock Exchange. One's called One Liberty Properties, OLP. The other's called BRT Apartments, BRT. You know, we have, I think, 220, 230 years of kind of old school real estate experience on our committee. So yeah, so without saying real estate too much and belaboring the point, like we have an old school downside protection mentality. And we assume kind of that no matter who the operator is, that if they can't survive in our space, and you know, this is pretty different than some of the other quote unquote real estate players in the space. If the user can't survive in our space, we're not going to make, you know, mid-teen rents like we are with a cannabis user or interest rate, but we're going to be able to make 5-6% with the usual industrial user. And at the minimum, we're going to be able to sell the property and at least get our investment back. So that's kind of our, you know, it's oversimplified, but it really is a simple strategy, right? Like, what is this real estate worth? And that's kind of as high as you can go in terms of basis.
So I think a lot of people understand the sell leaseback. Can you tell us more about how the mortgage portion would work?
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, it's like, you know, oftentimes it's a cross collateralized mortgage. So like, you know, a cannabis company has several pieces of real estate. We'll give them a loan secured by all of that real estate. Sometimes it's just a single property, but yeah, whether it's refinancing an existing lender or, you know, the cannabis company just owns real estate and they want to pull some money out of it, they don't want to sell their property, I'll give them a loan secured by their building, you know, up to 70% of kind of, again, how I perceive the non-cannabis real estate value of that building. It might be 70% of their cost. It might be, you know, closer to 40% of the cost, again, because there's, you know, a lot of other equipment, improvements, security, things like that, that I wouldn't really consider usual real estate value. But that's like short-term mortgage money, you know, anywhere from a year to like 3 years, you know, prepayable on the off chance that, you know, Safe Banking hopefully comes in or someone else is able to take my loan out at a lower rate. But like, that's a short-term financing solution for companies that want to continue to own their own real estate and for companies that think they might be able to get, you know, refinanced out. The sale leaseback stuff is a long-term ownership. We buy the real estate. We give maximum proceeds, like rather than a percentage of what I think the property is worth, we'll pay 100% of what we think it's worth. And that's the operator trying to cash out, basically, or not cash out, but at least, you know, get as much liquidity out of the real estate as they can.
Yeah, and on that point, you know, it's also something that differentiates you in terms of not giving credit or, you know, additional value for tenant improvements or equipment. But does that actually make you less competitive when you're going into some of these deals and your competitors can say, look, if Rainbow's going to do it at 10, we'll do it at 13 to 15 million or more?
I mean, yes, in certain ways, right? Like oftentimes I'll lose out on deals because IIPR or AFC or someone else is willing to pay a much, much higher price per foot or LTV than I would, right? Again, they're lending based off of the project cost. I'm lending based off of what I think the actual value of the building is and the downside. Our rates are generally a little bit lower than some of those businesses. So they're still, you know, well in excess of traditional real estate kind of loans or sale leasebacks. But they're cheaper than most of the other companies I just mentioned. So like, yes, we'll still lose out because people want maximum dollars. But at the same time, like, I think companies are starting to realize maybe I shouldn't, you know, build out five phases of this project at once and take on that much debt. Because on the off chance that there's price compression in my market this year, I might not be able to service that debt, right? And sometimes companies are biting off a little bit more than they can chew. So yes, we lose out business sometimes to companies who are willing to give more money than us. So just because we don't get every single deal doesn't mean there's not plenty of deal flow for us to do, right?
Yeah, and I think it's a trade-off between less cash immediately, but your rents are then also much lower, or not much lower, but definitely lower longer term. Well,
they will be much lower, right? Because A, like the actual rent rate I charge might be a bit lower, but B, it's like, you know, if you're paying 10% on $300, then your rent is $30. If you're paying 10% on, or if you're paying 10% on $150, it's half, right? So yeah, it's the rate's a little bit lower, but the actual cost to the borrower or the tenant is way lower because it's such a lower basis.
Yep. And then, you know, looking at your portfolio of tenants and borrowers, you guys pretty much go across the US, but help us understand a bit more about, you know, what markets do you have more of a presence in than others?
We have a pretty big California presence. We have a couple deals in Colorado, a couple deals in Michigan, one in West Virginia, four or five. We have five buildings in Missouri, but like, basically, we're in nine states total, and we're kind of market agnostic. You know, like, again, it's first and foremost about not just like, oh, are we in a good market in that state? But it's like, hey, are we buying the property at a good price relative to that market? And that's our main focus, right? So it's, I don't have a problem with California. In fact, we've been doing quite a few deals in California recently just because others do have a problem with California. So there's a lot of interesting deal flow there. We're about to do a deal in Colorado right now. I know it's a competitive market. But at the same time, like, we know who's successful in Colorado because we've seen receipts and actual sales for a long period of time. So there are some winners. We're trying to do a deal with one of those companies. But yeah, like, you know, unlike some other players in the space, I don't have a particular market that I love or hate. I was a little sad. I'm a New Yorker from New York, as are my partners. I was a little sour on New York up until recently because, you know, just from walking around New York, it's like you can get weed anywhere. And it's like there's, you know, there's no enforcement. And that obviously makes it hard for, you know, legal businesses to kind of to make money and thrive. I think New York is sort of changing their guidance now on how they're going to enforce, you know, illegal cannabis sales, which is obviously great for the industry. And so I've actually warmed up to New York and we're looking at a deal there. I've looked at a couple in Massachusetts, but I haven't done one yet. Like I said, we have a few in Michigan. Obviously that's a tough market. But anywhere in the United States where cannabis is legal is a market that I would look.
So why haven't you done anything in Massachusetts yet? Just thinking about, look, if you're doing a loan to or sell lease back to someone that has a dispensary, if they for some reason can't pay rent and that's a traditional retail location, you can probably find another tenant for it, right?
Yeah. No particular, like, again, nothing I'd really like nothing terribly wrong with Massachusetts as a cannabis state. Just for lack of an opportunity that we liked. We looked at a couple deals there. They were just higher on a price per foot basis than we wanted to pay. And so we didn't wind up doing it. We've probably looked at 5 or 6 deals in Massachusetts. There's certainly lots of opportunities there and plenty of companies who are looking for money and could use it. Nothing that we really don't like about the state, just not the right opportunity.
Got it. And on that point, how do you guys handle finding these deals? So from a sourcing standpoint, are you more so going out and finding opportunities? Are there a good mix that are coming to you?
Yeah, we have a, first off, we have a large, probably like 15 to 20 just cannabis brokers in, who broker these deals, who bring them to us all the time. We're getting, at least 3 to 5, I would say probably an average of 10 deals per week, maybe a little bit more, that are just inbound deal flows being sent to us through brokers. And then, Daya, I don't have to tell you, cannabis is a very small world, right? So like, I come from a real estate background. I used to go to the ICSC conference for real estate. Like, I haven't gone to that in 6 years. Me and my partners go to, every cannabis conference that we can. And that's the world that we live in. And it's a small world, right? So like, unlike some of the other businesses that my family runs, where, you're bidding against BlackRock and everyone else, and it's super competitive process, and like really have to be able to manufacture and find the deals. In my side of the world, like I mentioned earlier, there's just way less capital available than there is kind of capital being requested and needed. So the finding that we don't do much effort in finding the deals is the truth. The deals come to us. People know we're in the space. They know we have some money. They know we've done deals. And by virtue of that fact and the fact that we're pretty good people and we're not screwing anyone over and we're true to our word, right? We've built up a decent reputation for ourselves in this industry in the last 5-6 years. And the deals kind of come to us. Finding places to put the money is not the problem. Finding the money is certainly the harder part of the business.
Yeah, and on that point, you guys have 2 funds, right? Can you tell us the size of Fund 1 and Fund 2?
We actually have four vehicles in total. But we had our first fund was $50 million in equity that we raised. It's a friends and family fund. I mentioned my family, our business is about 30% of the LP capital in that business. So we're the largest investor. And then the rest of it was friends and family, and we did some crowdfunding. We have a fund of one with a foreign investment group and ourselves. And that's a $25 million vehicle. It only does loans. But basically through the vehicles, we'll co-invest, right? So like we just closed an $11.5 million deal in Santa Barbara like a week and a half ago. It was $6.5 million from fund two. It was $3 million from another vehicle. It was $2 million from another vehicle. So we'll just co-invest through the vehicles that we have into the exact same deals. They're all the same charter. Our second fund, which is, again, same setup as the first fund, friends and family, is a little over $45 million in equity raised today. Our goal is to get to about 60. We're still actually raising into that vehicle. It's been 33 of the 45 committed has already been invested, and everything in the fund is actually performing and doing quite well, which is kind of rare in this industry and great. But we're still raising money into that vehicle. And then we also have what's called a non-traded REIT, which is a company we started in partnership with ArcView Capital. It's called MJ REIT. And we're the advisor and the sub-advisor and the investment manager of that fund. So our partners kind of do the FINRA stuff and the fundraising, and we do the actual picking of the assets and the investing. That's just getting off the ground as well. It's like a $6 or $7 million vehicle right now. So all in all, we're at about $130 million and change in AUM, most of which has already been invested. All equity. We basically have no debt on our entire portfolio. Same reason it's hard for a cannabis company to get a loan. It's hard for a company like myself to get a loan. I do believe and certainly hope that that will change. I don't know if it's next year or 3 years or when, but I believe that will open up. But for the time being, like pretty much, yeah, it's straight equity that we've invested that we've raised through friends and family and ourselves and a little bit of crowdfunding.
Yeah, so a few questions on that. What's been a good avenue for you guys to find investors to raise capital?
My family was the lead investor initially, which is, it's like, that's a big benefit, just having, you know, one larger investor says, I'm going to take down 15, 20% of the total raise. So like having a lead was obviously very helpful. But then for us, like, again, you know, a little bit different than some of the other quote unquote REITs in this industry, like, we really look at the world from a traditional real estate standpoint. We just happen to make slightly higher returns because cannabis companies don't have access to banking and institutional investment and money in general. So our investors are by and large traditional real estate investors. We have very few cannabis investors on our cap stack. They're mostly just normal real estate investors. A lot of them from the tri-state area where we're from, friends and family, friends and friends of friends, business contacts, things like that. So most of our investors are kind of like sourced just through our own friend and family network. And I mentioned like we were on CrowdStreet, a crowdfunding platform for Fund One and Fund Two. I think we raised about $11 million total on that platform, which was great. But yeah, it's been like, by and large, it's been word of mouth, hustling, me being on the phone, friends of friends, trying to raise capital. And, you know, in today's market, people are sort of scared of cannabis generally, even though ours is a real estate investment. So it's like I said, right, it's finding places to go put the money to work is not the challenge. The challenge is raising the money itself.
Yeah. And what have returns been?
In our first fund, we're distributing 10% per year right now. We do it on a quarterly basis, so 2.5 per quarter. We make about 13.5-14% net of our fees. And then the difference, we just reinvest. It's like an 8-year fund with a 4-year investment period and a 4-year harvest period. So on the first fund, we're actually getting towards the end of the investment period. So we'll start returning some of that capital as well. But yeah, we've been distributing 10 and reinvesting the extra 4 in the first fund. And in the second fund, we're getting similar returns. In fact, like the returns are probably a little bit higher these days just because of the way the market's moved. But we're distributing 7% right now in the second fund just because it's not fully invested. Like I said, it's 33 of 45 million that's invested. We have a couple of deals in our pipeline. I think probably by the end of Q2, we'll be fully invested. We'll kick that up to a more like a 10%, you know, annual return on a quarterly basis as well. But similar to Fund One, like we're probably making 13-14% net of fees in that vehicle, and we just reinvest the difference in future deals. So like at the end of the day, I'm projecting for our investors like a 2 to 2.5x equity multiple between an 18% and a 22% IRR.
Yeah. And how does that benchmark relative to just traditional real estate REITs or funds?
I mean, look, there's all sorts of traditional real estate, right? Like it's like people do construction deals with like, you know, floating rate debt and things like that. Like, you know, they might project returns that are high 20s or 30s, but like I view those deals as very risky relative to like stabilized operating real estate with a cannabis company and a license already in there and equipment and other collateral above and beyond that. But like, just in terms of like a basic interest rate, like I think nowadays you can sort of put out money at 7 or 8% pretty comfortably on like a decent LTV from a lender's perspective. And for us, it's probably like, you know, 2 to 2.5 times that, kind of like, you know, maybe we'll put out money at a 15% interest rate or so, maybe a little higher, but like 2 or 3 points up front, 2 or 3 points on the back. If it's a 2-year loan, like, you know, that's sort of an 18 or a 19% IRR. So I would say it's like a little more than 2 times the traditional yield of real estate for stabilized stuff.
Yeah. So it feels like the returns are there. You're above benchmarks. It's more about just finding some of these limited partners to invest.
Yeah, for sure. It's I probably spend 70 to 80% of my time, honestly, trying to raise capital. Because like I said, like we've got, you know, about $23 million of liquidity right now. I'm looking at least $120 million of deals that I'd like to do. And we take on co-investors too, right? Like we have some of the large investors. And I mentioned like we'll do kind of participations in the deals that we'll do. So we'll have multiple funds investing. If some of our larger investors want to co-invest directly into deals, we offer that. And so we don't, you know, it's like SPVs that we'll do for each deal to, you know, increase our buying power.
And then on that topic, from what you mentioned earlier, don't some of your competitors have traditional banks lending to them? So how do you guys get to that point where someone, you know, that's on the traditional banking side starts lending to your fund?
Yeah, I think most of those that do are public, whether it's Canada or here on the NASDAQ. We made a decision, you know, even before the public markets turned and before the cannabis market turned about a year and a half ago, that we were just going to keep trying to, you know, cobble money together privately as best we can. We are talking to a couple banks. Like I said, we have a large unlevered portfolio of existing assets that would certainly make sense for a normal, you know, bank or lender, if not for the fact that the users were cannabis. But I think most of the other players who have debt are public, and that kind of helps them to get bank debt, especially if you're in Canada. You sort of have more access if you're publicly in Canada, which is tough for a lot of reasons, primarily because there's not a lot of float on the stock, obviously. But it does open up the chance that you get, like, you know, a Canadian insurance fund or a Canadian bank to kind of give you a loan. So we're like, hey, we're still working on it. We're negotiating terms with one bank in particular right now that I think is going to wind up being our lender. But at the end of the day, like, you know, all the returns I mentioned to you are on an unlevered basis, right? Like, if interest rates get higher and higher, like having that much leverage on, and cannabis companies might not perform, having that much leverage on your portfolio could be scary. So, like, you know, we're still going after it. And I think, again, a big part of it is just the fact that we're private. But some of my investment committee doesn't even want to get debt, even though it would juice our returns a little bit. Like, it's like, we're making good enough returns as is. It's safe the way it's structured. And so, yeah, we debate all the time whether it even makes sense to go get that debt.
That makes sense. And then on that point about some of your competitors running into problems, you know, IIPR has kind of been the news the past few months for certain tenants not paying their rent. Hasn't impacted the stock price too much. If I'm just looking at the last 6 months, it's down 15%. It's down a lot over the last 2 months, but not down a lot if you look at 6 months back. So what happens to an IIPR when some of their tenants either go out of business or can't pay these reduced rents even?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the fate really is for IIPR, but like, just looking at it like strictly on the asset level, right? It's like IIPR is in at a basis that, in my opinion, I mean, if anyone took a real look at their portfolio, they'd probably agree. But like, they're in at a basis that's way above and beyond like traditional non-cannabis real estate value, right? So like, point being, if a cannabis user can stay in that property and support the rent and make money, then like, you don't have any issues, right? If the cannabis company starts to have issues, they can't support your rent, you basically have two choices. You can reduce their rent substantially, which I think we've seen already in a few instances, or you can default them and try to get another user. And it's like, listen, if that cannabis company, you know, who might be a legitimate multi-state operator or whomever, if they couldn't make money in that facility, it's highly unlikely that some other company is just going to come in there with a magic wand and start making a ton of money. And so you're more likely, you know, releasing the property to a traditional industrial or agricultural user. And the non-cannabis user is going to pay a very low percentage of what this cannabis user might have been paying in rent. And at the end of the day, if you're selling the property, again, it's like you're probably going to sell it for what it's worth to a traditional agricultural or industrial user rather than what it may have been worth to a cannabis company who didn't make it, right? So I think, again, it's like, you know, if everything sort of went legal a year or two ago, I think everything would be fine, right? Like 280E would be away, businesses would be making money, banks would be, normal banks would be refinancing all this stuff, and a lot of that equity would be taken out. But because of the way it's gone in the last couple of years, You know, again, I think there's a lot of exposure on some of those assets that are just not, you know, again, if it's not a specialized user operating out of that property, it's just not worth what they paid to a non-cannabis user. So I view that as a decently high level of exposure.
Would you guys look at some of those deals where if you're getting a discount, you could buy them out?
I would, and I have, but like a 40% discount to what they're paying is way above what I think it's worth. So like I've looked at it on a number of occasions, but like there's a huge gap, a really big gap between what I think the property's worth and what they invested. So it's usually not happening.
Got it. And then what you were saying earlier about, you know, 100 million plus in the pipeline versus, you know, 15, 20 million of liquidity or whatever the number was, how do you prioritize then that pipeline? Like what gets funded then?
Like I mentioned, we have a few partners. So it's certainly like, and you know, they have some of the larger partners have say in some of the things we do. So part of it is what, you know, what my investors want to do. But at the end of the day, it's like, again, obviously, like first and foremost, does this real estate make sense from a non-cannabis perspective? Second, do we think this operator is this operator already profitable? Are they close to being profitable? They have like a legitimate business plan that makes me think they're going to be profitable soon, right? So like, yeah, you know, like it's not, I think we're well beyond the days of grow, and then sell, right? Like it's just not happening. Just like tech, just like a lot of markets, you know, cannabis no different. Especially from a lender's perspective or a landlord's perspective, like I'm looking for net cash flow. I'm looking for, can you support my interest payment? How much money does this business make? And if I think, you know, again, if I think my LTV or my purchase price makes sense, non-cannabis, and then if I think you can support the rent based on your business, based on the state, based on your operating history, whatever, then I'll do the deal. But it's like, you know, again, there's like a couple of pretty major boxes we have to check off before we decide to do something. And like I mentioned earlier, because there's just so little capital available and so much capital kind of needed, you have the opportunity from where we're sitting to be pretty selective with what you do.
Yep, that makes sense. And then from a, you know, prioritization standpoint where you're talking about, you know, the non-cannabis value, what are some of those criteria? So it's, you know, the city, it's the location, you know, building, like what are some of those factors that you look at?
Yeah, exactly. It's the city, where it is in the city, you know, how far it is from a highway, how good visibility, if it's retail, quality of the building itself, right? Like, has it been retrofitted? How old is the property? And like, you know, we're on the phone with like, you know, we're not in every single market in the country, obviously. So like we're touring these properties ourselves. We're on the phone with local brokers in those markets. Now I mentioned one of the other companies we run called One Liberty Properties. It's a net lease company. They operate in like 40 states in the US. So like we have channels with brokers we know in almost every market that we're in. And yeah, like, again, it's, you know, it's not just a building that's on Main and Main, right? Because you can have a MedMen on Abbot Kinney and it's an awesome location. But if you pay three times what the building is worth, just because it's a great location, doesn't mean you're in at a proper basis. Similarly, you can be in, you know, Sacramento or a slightly smaller market. That's an up and coming market and good, right? And you can be in a B+ location. And like, if you're buying that property at a price that's a good price for that location, then it's okay. So like, you know, it's a long-winded answer, but it's a combination of all the things you said. And again, it's like, just because it's a great location doesn't mean you're getting a great price.
Yeah, no, it has to make sense with all the factors that you guys look at. You know, last question for you. Any sort of you know, predictions for how 2023 is going? What are you guys paying attention to? I know it sounds like you spend more of your time fundraising, but on the operational side, you know, what are some of the predictions?
You know, like I hate to be too negative, but my predictions for the most part are kind of stagnant. I just don't see a lot changing, like, as you know, from a federal standpoint, from a legislative standpoint. I you know, I think we got to find a way to sort of ease up on 280E. Maybe we don't have to like wipe it out completely, but like, I would hope there's a version of this where the companies can take some deductions, because when they can't, it's honestly not fair. Like it doesn't matter how, you know, I know certain companies don't spend as they should and they can cut back and this and that, but like, it's almost impossible to make money in any business without taking deductions. So like, I think that's really unfortunate. I know there's been sort of like whispers about like rescheduling, but like, you know, just going from schedule one to schedule two isn't going to change that, right? So like that might happen, but like it's not a win for anyone is the truth. So like, I don't think that does anything for the market. I hope, you know, again, like I think the public stocks were at the price they're at right now. Like I personally think they're good buys. That said, like I'm not putting too much cash in that on a personal level, just because it's like, is now the time or like is 6 months from now the time, right? It's like, I don't know how much is going to change, you know, in the next couple quarters or maybe till the end of the year. So like, I think we're sort of looking at somewhat of a flat year as far as values go. And as far as, you know, legislation reform goes, right? And then like on the more, you know, like on a state by state or on an operator by operator level, like, I think it's inevitable that businesses who aren't making net profit are going to go by the wayside. Some of them will get scooped up. Some of them just won't ever operate. The lack of competition in some instances will actually be a good thing for those who can sort of last. But yeah, like I think for the next, I don't know, 9 to 18 months, right? It's like hunker down, try to survive, cut your cost, get better margins, hope prices come up in your state, like as others sort of fail. But yeah, like if, unfortunately, like I'm not predicting that much change. And like from a lender's perspective, it's like, hey, like if JP Morgan could start giving loans to all these cannabis companies, maybe it wouldn't be great for my business. But the truth is like, I don't think even if cannabis was legalized tomorrow, I think it takes a long time for everything to sort of quote unquote normalize. And the companies themselves really need help. And the states want these companies to make tax revenue. There aren't that many new businesses in America that are making all this tax revenue. So like, I do think something's got to give, but I just don't know if it's this year.
And I'm going to ask you for a number based on the amount of investment opportunities you probably see. So of those that you see that are revenue generating, what percent do you think in 12 months are going to be out of business?
Of the companies I look at or across the board?
That you, I guess both then, that you look at, that comes to Rainbow that says, hey, we need a loan for whatever amount, which is probably a smaller subset definitely than, you know, the broader landscape.
Yeah, I would say like, God, you're putting me on the spot and I hate to even like, when I think about it, it sort of feels bad, but like, I don't know, like to say a third of the businesses might no longer be operating a year from now seems like it's possible.
Yeah, that's not a stretch. I mean, we've seen some numbers where,
I think 60. Like, I think that's, I don't think more than half the people are out of business, but I think a third is realistic.
Okay.
And for the companies I look at, like maybe half that, just because like, if most companies don't even own their real estate, they're leasing it at a crazy rent. So like, it's like, at least if you have some capital in your business, like, you've got more of a chance. You can get a loan from me. Yeah. You can try to survive for a few more years, whatever, right? So like, I mean, what do you think? I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm about there. It's probably, you know, a third to 50%. I think 50% sounds high, but then that's if you're taking, you know, cultivation all the way to retail, right? I think if you look at just some of the deals you've done in California, a lot of the cultivators are struggling. So if you count, you know, a farm in Mendocino as one business, like that's probably closer to 50%, if not more. If you think about some of the dispensaries that are in smaller towns that aren't hitting certain numbers, even though there's not really a lot of retail coming online, they're just not making net income. So if it's not investable, if they can't raise debt, you're kind of a zombie company. So I kind of call that as, you know, dead or going out of business as well. If you're just kind of, you know, delaying the inevitable. Because a lot of these guys, as we've seen, can pump the debt payments, but at some point in time, things are going to come due and you're going to have to pay up.
Yeah. I mean, maybe these lenders will give you another year in the hopes that things change, but some of them are a lot of like, look, the truth is that a lot of the larger investors in cannabis, they made a bunch of money and they lost a bunch of money. And some of them are just fed up and they want out. Right.
Yep.
So that doesn't bode well for the operator who's almost breaking even, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of time and place is everything, right? If your business was raising money and you were where you are today in 2018, you would have been able to raise more capital, a lot more of it. So timing is definitely very key in this industry.
It's a good investment opportunity. Like everything is down right now. It's just like neither of us, you know, we spend our whole life in this industry. People spend more time on the legislative side than me. Nobody knows when things are going to get a little bit easier. And so that's tough to invest in.
Yeah. Yeah. Tough to invest if there's not a sort of outcome that's on the horizon. A lot of people have been wrong. So I think people have stopped making prediction on when legalization may happen.
Right. I used to also, but yeah.
Yep. No, I'm the same way. I've stopped.